Discussions in Depth Psychology is powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute. Your host is Bonnie Bright.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Discussions in Depth Psychology. I'm Bonnie Bright, and this series is dedicated to bringing you discussions with some of the individuals who are doing some inspiring work and also making some meaningful contributions to and through the field of depth psychology. And today my guest is Dr. Stacey Shelby, who is an author, speaker, and a depth psychotherapist. Welcome, Stacey. Thanks so much for spending some time with me today.
Thanks so much for inviting me, Bonnie. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, I'm so happy to have you here. Of course, we're going to be talking a lot about your new book, which was recently published in 2018. It's called Tracking the Wild Woman Archetype, A Guide to Becoming a Whole, Indivisible Woman. And, of course, we'll be talking about how women are influenced by culture, and we'll be discussing, among other things, individuation, suffering, transformation, and awakening, which are all topics that are, of course, near and dear to my own heart. So I'm really looking forward to that. But before we jump into the conversation, I'd like to first read your bio, and then we'll go from there.
Great.
Stacey Shelby, PhD, is the author of Tracking the Wild Woman, as I just mentioned. She's also a speaker and depth psychotherapist, and she's a registered clinical counselor, RCC, in Canada. She's a certified clinical dream tender, and she studied in shamanic and yoga traditions. She holds a master's and PhD in depth psychology with a specialization in Jungian and archetypal studies from Pacifica Graduate Institute. Dr. Shelby has a thriving clinical practice in Squamish, British Columbia, where she works with adults in various stages of personal transformation, both in person and via the internet. She is gifted at working with the symbolic language of the soul, and she is dedicated to honoring the soul as it presents in the lived experience of daily life. So, Stacey, boy, that is a description of depth psychological practice if I ever heard one. I just am so drawn personally to these things of working with the soul and really beginning to understand the language of the soul in order to create and support transformation in our own lives and, of course, the lives of those who are around us. So I'd like to jump right in, if we can, to the book, because there's so much rich material there. And, of course, it's on a topic that is all about transformation, as I had mentioned. It has the actual words wild woman archetype in the title of it. So maybe we can start there. And because of your background and your degree in Jungian and archetypal studies, can you start out by talking a little bit about what the wild woman archetype is?
It's a slippery concept to try to define. And, you know, of course, we like things defined very clearly. And as soon as they become clear, they become fixed. And the nature of this particular archetype is that it doesn't really want to become fixed. So, you know, I dedicated a whole chapter to try to define what the wild woman archetype is, and it just kept moving around. So let's maybe start chronologically. Historically, Dr. Clarissa Pinkola Estes wrote Women Who Run with the Wolves back in 1992. The subtitle was Myths and Stories of the Wild Woman Archetype. She's also a cantadora and a Jungian analyst and tells stories. So that whole volume was dedicated to stories that invoke the wild woman archetype in the symbolic language that story speaks. So I happened to read that book, you know, back when I was 20 and thought I understood it. I had no idea that I actually didn't even have the capacity to understand it. But it resonated at that just really deep, soulful level. And it stayed with me. I reread the book so many times over the years, and just that source of fascination and mystery that the soul provides. So in trying to define it in the most concrete term that I arrived at personally, I felt like it was an expression of a woman's soul, the true, authentic experience of who each individual woman is. Slightly different than how we might understand the word soul, in that the wild woman archetype is very closely related to the instincts, which are very closely related to the body. And so there's this really deep sense of embodiment that the wild woman speaks to us through. And I felt like that was kind of the most close to concrete definition I was going to get with this really mysterious figure that moves around. The other analogy that I really like and leaned into was very much about social constructionism and that question of who is a woman before she's socialized. meaning that our essential nature before we're enculturated is who we actually are. So to compare that, as an acorn always produces an oak, the wild woman archetype would always produce a woman. But each oak and each woman is going to be unique and a little bit different. And so I just really wanted to explore who that was for each of us, and it would be unique but similar.
Oh, that's such a great description, and I really appreciate that you first landed on this idea that it's a unique expression of the soul, because of course we all are, but we sometimes really lack the language, I think, to be able to talk about it. And so if you're someone who's hearing this and you're an academic and you understand in great detail Jung's archetypes and what he means by that, and, you know, can sort of even feel into those, I think that we probably deep down can get a sense of that. But I have to say, even as many years as I have studied depth psychology and Jungian psychology, I sometimes also feel like the archetype and the whole idea of the archetype is a little bit slippery. And I wonder sometimes if it's not because they are, in fact, changing even on some level. I mean, they're very structural. They're very core foundational pieces of the soul. And I really believe that that is the case, that our entire unconscious is built on these archetypes, as Jung has expressed it. But I also wonder frequently if archetypes are able to individuate, just like people individuate. And of course, that's another Jungian term that I'm kind of throwing out there that I'm assuming that people know what it means. But I'm wondering if you can help me make the link here between then this idea of the wild woman archetype, which is fundamental before a woman was enculturated, and then move that into this place of individuation and talk about what it means for a woman or anybody, I guess, to individuate. And then I'd love to hear your comments on whether or not you think archetypes actually individuate as well. That's sort of a side question, but an important one.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's lots of fun rabbit holes we could go down with that. Yeah, I love all these questions. That's great. I'll start with the last question first about, do I believe that archetypes individuate? So Christine Downing, who's really well known for her extensive work in mythology, was the chair of my work, and I suggested that the myth of Eros and Psyche was very often a guiding myth for women individuating with the wild woman archetype, in particular as it showed up in the struggles of relationships. And I suggested that the myth itself was evolving, which would imply then that the archetypes associated with the myth were also evolving. And she reminded me that, of course, archetypes are extremely stable, fixed patterns. And I think that's true, but I don't think they don't change. I don't think they're impermeable to change indefinitely. I think as we, let's say, expand our consciousness, so too do the archetypes expand their consciousness. We obviously do it much quicker as our lives are relatively short in the scheme of life, with a capital L. But I do think that they evolve and change, and the myths evolve and change. And so I suggested that the wild woman archetype was actually maybe a more current expression of psyche in the Eros and Psyche myth, except that instead of going back into regression, as symbolized at the end of the story by going to Mount Olympus, which I interpreted as regressing because she went back to the realm of the gods, which is the unconscious, as you said, where the archetypes reside, were built on those unconscious archetypes, where the wild woman actually remains conscious because the wild woman archetype remains with the body of the individual woman. So there's a very important differentiation, and with that implying that the archetypes and the myths do evolve, and in fact that the human soul evolves. Oh, that's a fun rabbit hole to go down for sure. And then, sorry, now Bonnie, I lost the other question about individuation.
Yeah, I think I was trying to get at how the process of individuation works for what you have conceived of as the wild woman. What is the role that it plays in her life?
Right. Yeah, and so this question actually tracks back to back when I was 20 and I thought I had the capacity to understand reading Dr. Estes's work, and yet I actually realized I didn't. I think we have to have a pretty strong ego container in the Jungian sense of, we have to have a strong sense of our identity and personality before we can actually come into engagement with the wild woman archetype. I don't think it's something that can happen too early in life, because the fortitude of the ego that contains the conscious personality isn't developed enough yet. So I believe it's something that happens at midlife, as Jung described that midlife individuation process. And, you know, it seems to happen through some sort of struggle. Something happens, and maybe it's even something wonderful, like the birth of a child. But it just causes us to reevaluate everything we thought we knew. We are no longer egocentric. We start to become aware of something else other than us. And I think that something else is the wild woman archetype. So we reevaluate who we are, what our individual values are, what our ideals are, what is okay for us, what is not okay for us, what we'll stand for, what we won't stand for. You know, in concrete terms, in relationships, if we're monogamous, if we're polyamorous, if we're somewhere in between, if we're not really sure, you know, like everything that we kind of thought we knew gets called into question, and we differentiate our personal identity at that more soulful level from the cultural values that we would have appropriated completely unconsciously. So that individuation with the wild woman archetype causes us to find out who we are, differentiated from culture, in part. That's a part of it. There's obviously more with individuation, but that's an important part that working with the wild woman involves. The other part I want to say about that, when I started this research, I had this, you know, the ego thing. I had this sense that I was the one trying to track the wild woman archetype, and I was the one seeking her. And then by the end of the research, I realized I had this totally backwards. She was the one that was tracking me from the very beginning. And she was the one that was impelling the research forward the whole way. I was just somewhat ignorantly following along, trying to figure out what was going on. So that's also a difference in how we relate with the wild woman archetype.
Yeah. Oh, that's really fascinating. I really appreciate what you're saying about the fact that she was seeking you, because of course, as we begin to come into relationship with this idea that everything is alive and ensouled, that of course includes the archetype, and the idea that our own unconscious or psyche or soul or however you want to refer to it, if we have to actually put it into terms and words that humans use to understand things, it's not surprising on any level, actually, that these kinds of energies or entities or ideas are seeking us, because I think the whole point of being here is in order to begin that journey of individuation and to seek transformation and to actually transform. But I have a question for you, because what it brings up for me is the question about if we are able to actually initiate this kind of transformation, or if it is something that just happens because of timing. You were talking about it, you know, might be too early at some point in your life to really be able to grasp or find or understand the wild woman archetype in particular. Do you feel like it was only as you began seeking her that she also kind of turned toward you and began tracking you as well? Or do you feel like this was sort of something that just happens at a given time in someone's life and it happens to everyone? What's your take on that?
I think personally, from both my personal experience and the vast majority, probably 70% of the people I work with in clinical practice are in their 30s, so usually in the stages of individuation and feeling quite lost. I think it's something that finds us, you know, some sort of existential crisis, spiritual crisis, some sort of something that happens that causes us to start questioning. And as soon as we start questioning, then we're on the road. I do think certain people, because there's no way to say how long the journey's going to take. Personally, for me, I felt like it was about a decade, which felt really, really long, because there's a lot of struggle involved. I see other people that seem to roll through it and kind of get to their level of depth in much shorter periods of time. Like, not everybody has the same propensity for depth as certainly people that are in the field of depth psychotherapy, right? In fact, I think we're kind of a small percentage.
I think you brought up a really good point when you said you struggled with it for about a decade as you felt that this was occurring to you. And, you know, I could probably tell a similar story, and I don't know if that's the case for everyone, but I do think that it often does feel like a struggle as you're going through that process. And of course, that seems natural because struggle is how we grow. There's also, I think, a certain element of suffering that happens within that. And of course, some schools of thought say that the suffering is only caused by our attachment to certain things. I'm sure many people are familiar with that concept, but can you say more about the role of suffering in this whole process? And is there a difference between struggle and suffering?
Yeah, there's definitely a difference. If we resist, we are going to suffer. So if we struggle against what's happening, we're going to suffer. The more we can surrender into it and just this is what's happening and have an awareness that there's a process and like really somatically staying with our breath when it gets really intense, not going into fight or flight, or at least starting to recognize when we're going into fight or flight, you know, and all the negative self-talk and stuff. So as soon as we can start to surrender into the process of whatever it is that's happening, there's less suffering. So surrender is a very big part. And I think surrender is quite closely related to struggle. Like if you're resisting, you're struggling.
Yeah.
Now, the thing about suffering from a depth psychological point of view, I don't necessarily agree that suffering is because we're attached, or the way that says that, it implies that attachment is somehow a bad thing. I think it's essential. In fact, I think maybe that's a big part of our Western malaise is that we're too unattached and therefore too lonely. So attachment, and certainly a secure attachment with other human beings and pets and nature and beauty and art and all these things, it's essential to who we are as human beings and wild women and wild men. So I guess I shy away from that more Buddhist notion that the root of all suffering is attachment, because then it causes people to like, oh, we can transcend suffering if we don't attach. Let's not do that. You know, let's attach and let's love and live while we're here because we can, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think what we can do with suffering, in some types of suffering, and definitely not all, because I know there's some types of suffering that we can't reckon with, or certainly the majority of us mortals can't reckon with. But if we can find meaning or a silver lining or something that gives greater depth to our lives through the suffering, greater purpose, then the suffering becomes endurable as opposed to paralyzing. Even though we might go through stages of being paralyzed with the pain, the emotional and physical agony that can be characterized by suffering. Mm-hmm. So trying when we can to find what the gift is. You know, and even in awful situations, we can sometimes find a greater appreciation for life at the very least, right? Hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, it's so critical to remember and yet so hard to remember when you're actually going through something like that. So mm-hmm. I really appreciate that you have identified that here. You know, I noticed that the subtitle of the book, so the book is called Tracking the Wild Woman Archetype, but the subtitle is A Guide to Becoming a Whole Indivisible Woman. And you have hyphenated that word indivisible. Can you say something more about what that means to you and why you did that?
I like that word. It's one of Jung's many definitions for individuation. And it was the one that really resonated for me personally. Because, of course, like wild woman archetype, individuation is quite a monstrous concept to try to define as well. You know, in short, we can say the ego becomes in service to the soul or the self with the capital S. And there's that transition that happens. And, you know, we can call that a spiritual awakening and these kinds of things. And that's the very short version. And that is kind of what happens. But I also really like where he defined it as we become indivisible. So individuation and indivisible being where the word actually comes from. We're no longer divided. So opposites within ourselves, paradoxes, become held, usually within some sort of symbol. And of course, the mandala, the circle, is a symbol of wholeness and totality of what Jung called the self or the personality, the whole personality, including conscious and unconscious. And so when we can reconcile all apparent opposites, conscious and unconscious, male and female, black and white, good and bad, as we get more and more of these paradoxes reconciled within ourselves, we become whole and we can hold all of our personality so much better. Now, it's not to say we ever become fully conscious of what is in the unconscious. That, I think, is absolutely impossible. But we at least become conscious that there is an unconscious and that it has a tremendous amount of effect on our life. So this indivisible word is about becoming whole and unshakable in our own foundation of our soul or ourself.
Whole and unshakable. I really appreciate that terminology. So I know you have a thriving practice, of course, a depth psychotherapeutic practice. Do you have certain exercises or ways of working with people that you feel are really kind of on this path and that you know are very interested in the idea of individuation? How do you work with people who are wanting to work with the Wild Woman archetype especially?
Well, you know what's interesting? I did my doctoral research on the Wild Woman archetype. I expected I would be working with women, mostly. And my practice is about 50-50. It's about half men and half women, which has just been wonderful. Like, it's just so wonderful to have both perspectives. But I guess the first rule of thumb with therapy is meeting people where they're at. And as I mentioned earlier, not everybody, in fact, I think very few, have the same propensity for depth and soulful engagement as certainly somebody who's done a PhD in depth psychology, right? There's not a whole lot of us out there, and we hang out together because we all have that same thing in common. So in terms of tools or practices, it's wherever the person is at. Some people like to talk to me. A lot of people I work with work in different folk medicine and indigenous traditions. I've had extensive experience there, so I'm going to help them integrate those symbols and teachings. Other people are very often having struggles with relationships or work, vocation, calling, purpose. You know, so we're going to work with that. Well, what's that doing symbolically? Other people love to work with dreams and rituals, so we're going to work with that. Some people like to really work with their body, so we might do a guided visualization or an active imagination meditation. We might do that. So it really is unique to where people are at. Because I'm a registered clinical counselor that has an ethics body, I stay within the container of what the ethics allows. So it's generally traditional talk therapy. It's just what we're talking about and the way we're talking and the symbolic language and how we interact and all those things are going on in that setting. I'm also always very aware, this is courtesy of Steven Eisenstadt, taught me in the dream tending, which has been tremendously helpful, very aware that my archetype of Chiron is engaging with my client's archetype of Chiron. And most of the time, I think it's those two that are doing most of the work, and we're just having a little chat some days. You know, like the work really, really happens. The big transformation work really happens at that archetypal level. And related to that, it really happens at that personal care level, again, about the attachment, right? Like allowing the therapist and the client to attach and feel secure and have genuine care. Therapy, therapia is Latin for care. It's about care, and care heals. Like, love heals everything. Not everything, but a lot, you know?
Yeah, that's beautiful. You know, that's why I appreciate a depth psychological approach so deeply. I mean, therapy in general, of course, I am a believer, and I always think that there's something beneficial about it, but the capacity to be able to hold it from that perspective. I mean, what you just said about how your Chiron, who is the wounded healer archetype, is working with their Chiron, and somehow by the time those two figures get their work done, then the two of you are just kind of taking it in and going with whatever is happening in that process. And I mean, on some level, that sounds almost magical to me, but I mean magical not in the sense of magical thinking that kind of gets a bad rap, but really allowing those unconscious processes and figures to do the work that they need to do and that we know they can do in order to create that transformation. So it's really powerful. I appreciate so much your description of that. I'm curious, as we begin to kind of come full circle here, as to why you wrote this book. You were in the Jungian and Archetypal Studies program, so there must have been a million archetypes out there that you could have chosen, and yet this is the one that came up for you. And I heard what you said about reading Clarissa Pinkola Estes' work, and I heard some of it, but is there something more to the story about what it was that really pushed you over the edge in choosing this as your particular topic to actually write a work of this length about?
Yeah, talking about resistance, I had a lot of resistance. Struggling. I didn't want to, and I didn't want to do it with alchemical hermeneutics, like, because I knew that was going to change me. And, you know, the ego is just not terribly fond of change. It likes to keep us safe, right? That's its job. It's trying to protect us. It's trying to be very helpful, but at a certain point, we do have to transform. And I knew that going down this path was going to do that, and so there was a lot of resistance to do it. I did at one point want to, like I mentioned, I've studied a lot in folk medicine, in particular from the Amazon, and I did entertain very seriously doing my doctoral research on plant spirits, plant medicine, spirits and archetypes being quite easily interchangeable from shamanic traditions and depth psychology traditions. And so I thought I would go that way, but then that just wasn't opening up, and it felt kind of complete in a lot of ways for me. So I was having dreams and dreams about bears, and it was bears everywhere. And they started out terrifying, and it was scary, and I live in Squamish. We live with bears. There's like 4 bears a day I was seeing. And I mean, he sees 4 bears a day. It was just insane. So all these bears were everywhere. And so I kept working very heavily with the symbol of the bear. And so the symbol of the bear is woven through the whole work. In fact, it opens with a beautiful poem called Spring by Mary Oliver about the bear coming down the mountain and her wordless love. And it also ends with the story about a bear as well. So at some point before I had decided this was the way I was going to go, I had a dream about a bear. Of course, I'm working my dreams all the time. That is a very big part of my practice, so I'm always working my dreams. And this dream, maybe I'll just tell it briefly, was I'm on a farmstead. It's my farmstead, and the bear and her cubs are at the edge of the farm. And I see her, and she sees me, and there's the other farm animals. And then she's coming towards me, and she doesn't normally do this, so I was like, oh, boy. So I go into the farmstead, into the kitchen, and the door is just one of those, like, old green doors that just kind of flaps open and closed. It doesn't really do much except keep mosquitoes out. And so I hide in this little square box in the corner of the kitchen, and the bear comes just right into the kitchen. And I'm peeking through my little box, and I don't really fit in the box anyway, so I'm really squished. And she stands up. And then I think, oh, I know this bear. I recognize her. And then I realize that I'm looking at myself, that the bear is me. And then I wake up, and I was like, oh, wow, that was a big dream. So I worked with that one quite a lot. And it was out of that dream that it became clear to me that this was the direction I needed to go. So the symbol of bear and the symbol of wild woman are very interchangeable for me.
Well, it's great. You know, it's such a great example of the unconscious just, you know, popping up and psyche saying, here's what it is. Here's what needs to be done. It was seeking you. And I really get that completely from that example of the dream. So thank you.
I was not going to her. That's right. Yeah. It finds us. Yeah. It wants to find us. It wants us to find her. Right.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm sure that there are any number of ways that any of us can put ourselves into that kind of an open, receptive sort of situation so that it can find us a little more easily. And like you said, when we resist against it, sometimes that does create challenges that we probably would rather not have. But it's also a big red flag that says there's something here that you should be listening to.
Yeah.
Well, I so appreciate the work that you've done, Stacey. It's just such a wonderful book. I'm really excited to see it go forward in the world. I know that it was published just in January of this year, 2018, and so it's wonderful to be a part of your journey in this way. Really looking forward to seeing what you do next. I've been speaking today with Dr. Stacey Shelby, who is the author of Tracking the Wild Woman Archetype, A Guide to Becoming a Whole, Indivisible Woman. And, of course, Stacey is also a speaker and a depth psychotherapist. And you can find out more about Stacy on her website at drstacyshelby.com. And her name is spelled StaceySHelby. So it's drstacyshelby.com. And of course, Stacy, you also have profiles on Facebook and Instagram. And so people can look for you there and keep an eye out for what you are going to do next. Thank you so much for spending some time with me today. I so appreciate it.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Bonnie. It's been wonderful.
You've been listening to Discussions in Depth Psychology, powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute with host Bonnie Bright.
Learn more at PacificaPost.com or at Pacifica.edu.